I just got a phone call out of the blue. We need you to come down and look at some pictures. So I went down there, had to look at a photo array and pick him out.
They decide, oh, sure, he's a low risk to reoffend. That is their conclusion.
They have no right to undo what the court did and what the prosecutor did.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, we are so honored to have returning back to us Danielle, who's going to jump right back into things after she introduces herself, but who, for all our listeners tuning in, Danielle started this incredible story last week. So go back and pick up that episode if you haven't had a chance to hear it, because we're going to continue on now with Danielle's story. Danielle, please introduce yourself to our listeners.
My name is Danielle Tudor, and I am a rape survivor and now rape survivor advocate and activist.
Well, it's great
Superwoman.
To have you back.
I just want to add Superwoman.
Absolutely. Well, Danielle, when we left off last week, we were talking about what happened. You know, we were talking about the statute of limitations, the fact that at the time when you were victimized by this serial rapist, this serial child rapist, that the statute of limitations was 3 years, and it wasn't until almost 20 years later that the statute was increased to 6 years, but still woefully inadequate, because all of the studies that have been done say the minimum, that the average is 20 years for a child sex victim to come forward, and like 50% of them wait 30 years. So
that's right.
It's ridiculous to have a statute of limitations that's only 6 years.
Well, and just to recap for everyone who might have gotten distracted over the last week, although how you could forget anything about Danielle's story, I don't know. Danielle was 17 when Richard Gilmore, whose name we normally wouldn't use, but it serves a purpose here, and we'll explain that, when Richard Gilmore broke into her home when she was home alone, violently attacked and beat her and raped her. She survived. But it was 1986 before Gilmore was arrested for another attack and rape. And it turned out he had attacked and raped 9 young women and girls as young as 13. And so he's facing the court. He decides to go to what I call a long guilty plea, otherwise known as a bench trial. And Danielle, you were telling us last week that the prosecutor was really, really smart, because he wanted to make sure the judge understood who he was dealing with. And I'm wondering whether possibly he used what's called similar transaction evidence, which I use many times as a state and federal prosecutor. In the federal system, it's called 404B. So what it is it is, in the case especially of someone who's claiming they are innocent or that they didn't do it, the prosecutor can bring forward evidence of similar crimes that the offender has committed that are similar to the one that is charged in the indictment, in order to show the trier of fact, the judge or the jury, that it is more likely that the person committed this crime because he committed these other exact crimes as well. So perhaps that was the kind of evidence the prosecutor was bringing forth. But can you set the scene for us a little bit at those hearings or that trial in front of the judge? When you enter the courtroom and you have to look at the defendant, I mean, were you prepared for that? How did you deal with that?
You know, I don't think any of the victims in my neighborhood, I don't think any of us thought that those cases would ever be solved. So we had all pretty much gone on with our life. And then all of a sudden, I just got a phone call out of the blue. We need you to come down and look at some pictures. And I'm just like, what? So I went down there, had to look at a photo array and pick him out. And the information we were given was fairly limited at that time because they knew mm-hmm. they were going to go to trial. So we were all subpoenaed to go to the trial and have to give testimony and, oddly enough, be cross-examined by Gilmore's attorney. But we all did it. And you could tell even at that point in time that the enduring effects were so very real. And we even had one victim that committed suicide after trial.
Oh, Danielle. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So it was very, very real to go through that. And when the judge did hand down the sentence, he made it very clear that he was giving him the longest time possible he could on every single charge with Tiffany. Yeah.
But Danielle, I'm really fascinated is really the wrong word. I'm struck by the bravery of you and these other young women at the time, still very young women at the time, who were able to go into court and face him. And of mm-hmm. course, I specialized in crimes against women and children. So I'm very familiar with trying to prepare victims yeah. of these crimes for what it's going to be like when they see this offender for the first time in court. And I'm wondering what was going through your mind when you saw Gilmore for the first time since he ran out of your house, you know, nearly a yeah. decade earlier.
You know, Francie, we were all kept separated. We couldn't talk to one another, all the victims. We couldn't talk or anything. And I remember, and we couldn't be in the courtroom either. And I remember my mom coming out to me before I testified. And she said, "You have got to be bold and you have got to tell the truth." She said, "These other women, they are just crumbling with Aww. This whole process." And she said, "You have got to be very direct and forceful with what you have to say." And I'm just like, okay. So I remember sitting in that box up on the stand and having to look over at Gilmore and just thinking, I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. And now when I go back and read the transcript of how it all went down with my testimony, I think, yeah, there was a little attitude there with everything that happened.
Good
so,
for you.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something.
And I don't think there was even victim. Oh, sorry, Jim. I don't think there was even victim witness assistance back then, you know, in the 80s. It was something that we did
nothing.
Have when I became a prosecutor in the 90s. But I mean, it's just astonishing to me that you were able to do it. And frankly, I'm wondering whether your mom actually just put more pressure on you than was even necessary. But yeah. I totally understand yeah. what you're thinking. Jim, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's all right. But did you testify once or twice? Did you give a victim impact statement or did you just
no.
testify in the trial?
Trial. What happened? Just the trial. Tiffany was allowed, the law went into effect 2 days before her rape, that victims now had the right for a victim impact statement. So oh, Tiffany wow. was able to do that. Yes. I mean, the law had just changed. I mean, it's remarkable. But we did not give a victim impact statement. We were definitely just part of the trial.
All right. But so, Francie, we should transition into what's going on right now. And
yeah,
I'll let Danielle tell our listeners what the situation is. He yeah. was sentenced to 60 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. I mean, that is for the 1980s, that is a massive sentence
Absolutely.
For a sex offender, even a serial sex offender. That is a judge who understood that mm-hmm. he had a dangerous sexual predator sitting in his courtroom who needed to be incapacitated permanently. I mean, I think you had said earlier he was maybe around 27. A 60-year sentence would have put him well into his 80s and should have incapacitated him basically for life in what I like to call a pine box sentence. Yeah. I feel certain the judge thought he was giving a pine box sentence. But Danielle, let's fast forward. Let's fast forward to some parole hearings. Can you talk to our listeners?
Well, first, wait. The sentence was reduced. It was cut in half.
Yes, it was.
That's
not a parole yeah. hearing.
You know, historically, in this particular case, the parole board has worked against us at every point and juncture. So it was common practice after a high profile case that they would go in and review the sentence. So they did that 8 months after trial. They went in and they looked at a sheet of paper, just like they're doing over three decades later. They're looking at a sheet of paper going, oh, one rape, 60 years. I even have the piece of paper that they printed out. Really, really extreme. And they unanimously voted, let's cut it in half, period.
That's right. That's what juries don't understand when it comes to things like sentencing. Parole boards have more power than the judge does because everyone under their custody is in their custody and they decide how long they spend in prison. Except it doesn't matter what the judges say.
Actually, it does. It does, because the new parole board rule actually limits their ability to do what they did. And this is what's important. We have to talk about this because the new parole board rule says any person determined by the prosecuting attorney, the court, or the board, it doesn't give the board final determination. They have no right to undo what the court did and what the prosecutor did.
But they did
that.
Yet they are doing it.
We have to be outraged. We have to tell the board 100%. And the court and the prosecutor that we are outraged.
And but what's insane?
Everybody listening to this should write to the prosecutor, write to the court, and definitely write to the parole board.
Well, and write to the governor. They ought to be writing to the governor.
Well, write to the governor too. But they are usurping the role of the prosecutor and the court. They are diminishing them, and they are hurting these victims. The parole board cannot do this under their own rule.
Well, but who's in the best position to understand the dangerousness of offender? That is the court and the prosecution, and specifically the court in imposing sentence, which isn't always good enough in my opinion. But still, when the court is imposing sentence, it is that jurist who has listened to people like Danielle, who has taken testimony from expert witnesses who understands the actual crime. Where you have a parole board later who is looking at paper. And that's what I want to talk about, Danielle. So just months after he gets a 60-year sentence, the parole board decides to reduce it to 30 years. So let's talk about the parole board, because there are a lot of people in this country who probably don't understand, A, how powerful they are, and B, who the hell they are, and see how the hell they get the jobs. So let's talk about Oregon a little bit, which I think is very similar to every other state in the country. In Georgia, for example, where I sit, the governor appoints the parole board. I think there might have been some reform recently where I think the state legislature might get one appointee, but the governor gets the majority of the ability to appoint the parole board. So they're rarely people who are qualified to be deciding sentences for offenders. Instead, they tend to be political patrons of the governor. Is that the same in Oregon?
That is exactly the way it is.
Disgusting. They're not experts. They're not experienced.
No. And you know, when they reduced that sentence, none of us knew it. And so he started None of us knew.
You weren't given notice?
Mm-mm. We thought we would never have to face this situation again. Even Gilmore and his attorney were upset because we're like, well, my client's never going to get out of prison. And that was kind of the point. But no one knew that they went in and cut it in half. And then they started holding parole hearings at 15 years. And they didn't tell anyone. They held parole hearings in 01, 03, 05, 07, never notified the prosecutor or any of the victims.
And if I'm not mistaken, Danielle, in 2007, the parole board recommended he be released in 2007.
They did.
I mean, he hadn't even done the 30 years at that point.
You want to know what their reasoning was? We know that your file looks really bad and your psychological evaluations are really bad, but we think we can take a chance on you.
What? Oh my God, take a chance on a child rapist, Jim.
No, they're not taking a chance on that person. They're taking a chance on the whole community.
That's right.
Just outrageous.
And every child. I mean, I like to ask people, which child is it okay with you that your mistake comes to light because he rapes? How many kids are there? How many kids is it okay for you to put in that situation by taking that kind of chance on a serial rapist. So 2007, they have this hearing. You don't even know about it, Danielle.
No one knew.
When's the first time you knew about a parole? Well, first of all, if the parole board recommended release in 2007, thank God he wasn't released. But why wasn't he released?
Because of the tenacity of victims and the prosecutor. So Tiffany found out purely by accident that this had happened. Tiffany's mom called the parole board and said, I don't think so. You did not tell us, you know, that you had these hearings and by law, you have to. So they held a mini hearing and get this, the victim gets 3 minutes to speak while the offender, they're talking to him for 4 or 5 hours. And then, so they did this little mini hearing to make the prosecutor and the Edens family happy. And then came to the same decision. We are going to release you. We can take a chance on you. So the arrogance of these idiots. That's right. They were like, yeah, we're not going to do nothing. Well, this is what we're going to do. And that's much like what I'm facing today in this other issue. But so what they did is the prosecutor's office and the Edens family filed the lawsuit against the parole board and they won, which then forced another parole hearing in 2008. And it's at that point that I was contacted by the DA's office. And I'll be completely honest with you. When he asked me to step forward and go to that parole hearing and share my story, I said no. Because I had lived my life not being Danielle
Shooter,
a rape victim.
Danielle,
yeah.
Every right.
I didn't know what I would find when I went back to that dark time. So I said no, and I didn't know it at the time, but all of us said no, except Tiffany. And I happened to see a media piece with Tiffany on it, and there was such compassion in my heart that I knew I had made the wrong decision. Because I think compassion always propels us, I think, to action and to act upon it. And so I called the DA back. Parole hearing had already taken place. And I just said, I'm so sorry, I made the wrong decision, and I will do whatever you need. And, you know, even to today, I'm still acting upon that promise of being able to do whatever needs to be done.
And well, what happened after that?
After I came forward, multiple other victims of Gilmore shared their story. And the parole board took almost 3 months to release their decision, but they said, we're not going to let you out. But what you don't know about Gilmore, during that time in 2008, he actually threatened to slit the bitch's throat. So he made that threat while he was in prison, and other inmates reported it, which, by the way, corrections officers who were working with him at the time actually went to the DA and said, they better not release this guy. And you had women that left that profession because they had to work with Gilmore. He was just that creepy.
And yet the parole board before that had said, oh, sure, we can take a chance on him. He's worth taking a chance on.
So there is something on Gilmore's file from 1990. He actually called one of the victims who lived in Hawaii now and said, you girls are going to pay for this.
Jesus.
And to this point, they have refused to acknowledge that threat, but it is a very real threat. And the victim knows that it was a very real threat.
Well, of course he's a real threat. He's a violent sex offender.
Called. Right. You know what his punishment was? We're going to take away your phone privileges.
Oh, my God. What is wrong with people?
Okay, so they searched his cell after that phone call in 1990. They find a list with his victims, with their phone numbers, addresses, their relatives. And you tell me that didn't raise a red flag? There was nothing. We're just not going to let you use the phone. And so far, DOC has refused to release in his file. And now I've asked for it again now. But they have refused to release in his file that is what his reprimand was in 1990, because they don't want the public to know the truth.
Okay, so first of all, you know, so many outrages in this case that I mean, I can't even begin to count them. But start with the prosecutor having to file a lawsuit against the parole board to get them not to release a dangerous serial rapist, first of all. Then, of course, you've got the parole board, which seems determined to hide evidence and keep Gilmore always on the verge of getting out. So I know there were parole hearings over the years. And I think, Danielle, another outrage has to be how hard the parole board tried to keep you from testifying at these hearings as if you didn't matter, as if you weren't a victim. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, his 2012 parole hearing was coming around, and outrageously, the parole board said, well, we're not going to let you speak because you do not meet our definition of victim. And I'm like, what? How is that possible? I spoke in 2010 at his parole hearing, but now I wasn't a victim that could even give testimony.
That's because they didn't want you on the record, Danielle. They wanted to let him out, and they knew if you and any of the other women testified, they wouldn't be justified in letting him out.
Exactly. They're trying to hide the ball, sweep it under the rug and be a bunch of idiots, ignorant idiots that, you know, that are insulated from any kind of negative ramifications
or accountability, Jim, because no one even knows who they are generally.
But here's the thing. I have to go back to that. Their own rule does not give them the sole authority to make that determination. And I believe that the prosecution and the court has already on record as making the determination that you are a victim who has suffered as a result of this crime that they are actually that they have in front of them because you testified in that trial.
Exactly. We're part of the mind.
As a victim, part of the case. You didn't testify as an expert witness. You didn't testify as somebody who's uninterested. They never would have been able to get you on the stand unless you were a victim.
So Danielle, 2012, the parole hearing, they didn't want you to testify. What happened?
I sued. I sued to be recognized as a victim. And when that popped up, they backed down. They didn't want to go down that road again. So they allowed me to speak, which then led to 3 years in a parole board work group with DA Russ Ratto. And we redefined who was a victim for the parole board. And then it was adopted in 2015. Mind you, at this point, I am the most well-known rape survivor in Oregon with the biggest voice. Well, we're doing this parole work group. The parole board is having another work group where they are deciding they're going to use the Static 99 exclusively. Now, they have said they brought stakeholders together. I am going to demand to know who those stakeholders are because it did not include any victims. So I'm already in a work group with you. And now you're doing one behind my back that's going to undo what we're doing because now I'm not going to be a victim again in your eyes.
We talked, Jim and I talked about, I don't want to rehash it, Jim, because it's in episode 304 where you and I talk about the garbage that is the 10, question only on paper, Static 99 that's based on bullshit recidivism rates instead of actual reoffense rates, which nobody can really calculate. So it's garbage. It's just a garbage tool that's used as an excuse to let sex offenders out. Okay, so 2015, fast forward, Danielle, tell us what's happening.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First, he ruined Twitter. Now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Okay, so they adopt the rule every, you know, and I'm still changing laws. We do the rape kit backlog, belong to the governor's task force, or you're just moving right along. And boom, you know, we get to 2016. Gilmore decides he doesn't want to have a parole hearing because he sees his psych evaluations and goes, these aren't good. So I'm just not even going to go down that road. Parole board says, okay, no more parole hearings for you then. And we're going to let you out on this date, which is around the time that we thought that he was released. But here's what that did. That then meant that because he was going to be released just right around his good time date, that meant no more psych evals either. So,
Let me make sure I understand. Yeah. So in 2016, he says, I don't need any more hearings. My psych evaluations are bad, and I'd have to have one in order to have another parole hearing and maybe get a release date. So instead, the parole board rewards him and says, we're going to release you toward the end of 2021, even without a hearing and no more psych evals.
Exactly. Oh, and I think that was calculated because now he's of course been released, but it didn't require a current evaluation that would show us that this man has not gotten better. So he's had probably close to 24 psych evaluations, and he's never really, I don't think he's ever passed any of them. And
okay, but the outrage here, Danielle, is what Jim and I talked about in our previous episode. And that is that they did a static 99 risk assessment.
Yes.
And he was, which just means someone shuffling paper. They're not even interviewing. They're just shuffling paper and looking at his offense on paper. And they decide, oh, sure, he's a low risk to reoffend. That is their conclusion of this garbage static 99 tool, that he's a low risk to reoffend. And Danielle, what I want you to tell people is what the significance of him getting out as a sex offender categorized as a low risk to reoffend means to the community. Tell us that.
Well, first of all, it means that Tiffany nor I nor any of his other victims get to know where he lives. So imagine we're now the criminal. He can find us on the internet, but we don't get to know where he is, where he lives, works. We don't get to know
any of that. He can move in next door. He can move in next door.
He sure could. And then that also means the community. So wherever he moves to or lives in the state of Oregon or Multnomah County, as long as he's there, no one will know. So the other piece to this that
and
is
he's
really,
what is he now? About 63, right, Danielle?
He's 63.
So let me just ask Jim Clemente, a profiler and expert on sex offenders. Jim Clemente, have you ever known of a sex offender, a violent rapist who was over the age of 63? I'm just curious. Are they cured by the time?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. They are not cured. And 60s, 70s, 80s, it doesn't matter. 90s, it doesn't matter because, one, they still are sexually attracted to children. They are still people who connect violence with sex. And their sexual attraction doesn't just go away. So they are still dangerous. They remain dangerous, and they will always remain dangerous, period.
Yeah. So he's out. He's not the age the original sentencing judge thought he should be before he's allowed to get out. So what else is going on in that case, Danielle? So this was toward the end of the year that I was doing this research and seeing this case and talking about it. And Jim and I were talking about it. And he was supposed to get out at the end of the year. Did he get out?
Yes, he got out on December 16th.
So, and that is why, sorry, Danielle, one more, just like Jim said, I was going to interrupt you one more time. I just want people to know that's why we've been using his name, because this guy is now out in the community. He's out in Multnomah County. He's out in Oregon. His name is Richard Gilmore. You should look up his case. You should look up his composite. You should look at his booking photo. You should look at his photos now. That and all the news accounts, there are photos of him because public beware, this is a dangerous, violent predator. And in the end, I'm going to ask you something about whether or not Oregon should be filing a civil suit to have him civilly committed as a sexually violent predator, Jim, which under SORNA, Sex Offender Registration Notification Act, and other laws, the Adam Walsh Act and others, there is a mechanism to find him a sexually violent predator and hold him in a civil commitment beyond his criminal penalty. So let me ask you, Danielle, is he still out in the community today as we're talking in early 2023?
Yes, he is. And if we were SORNA compliant in Oregon, he'd be a level 3 offender with one conviction. So,
which would mean the public would be able to know exactly where he lives.
And
he'd have
so
to check in with the sheriff every month. They'd take a photo of him. They'd be, you know, searching his residence. That's what tier 3 means. But
right,
he's a tier 1 offender, which is garbage because Oregon's not in compliance with SORNA.
Right, right.
How can they get away with that, Francie?
Well, you know, that's because every administration which has the carrot and the stick approach when it comes to SORNA compliance, Jim, and every successive administration since SORNA was passed way back in the day has decided it should instead be the carrot and just, hey, please be in compliance. Please do this. Please do that. Instead of pulling the funds that they could pull from Oregon in order to force them into compliance with
the
Sex Offender Registration Notification Act.
They are pulling funds from these states that are not compliant. Oregon is losing funds, but you're not hearing that.
But they don't care?
They don't care. These states,
oh my God,
that, these states that won't comply, they're like, well, you know, how much money is it? You know, so they're looking at that versus what they what the political will is, which in Oregon, it really is becoming a state that is definitely,
well, and you know why?
The criminal.
The reason these states refuse to comply with SORNA is all about money. It's disgusting.
Yep.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to them myself when I was up in at DOJ in DC. They do not want to comply because it's going to cost them money to categorize offenders, and they don't want to do it. They don't want to spend it. They don't want to pay people to categorize offenders. They'd rather just lose whatever the funds are rather than spend the money to protect the damn public from dangerous sexual predators.
It's money that motivated them to solely and exclusively use the Static 99. They didn't want to spend any more money on classifying your dangerous offender. So it all does
come down
to money. So we petitioned the governor to direct the parole board to make changes. She absolutely would not do it.
I see you tweeting at her. I see you tweeting at the governor, Danielle.
I am tweeting at the new governor, which is Tina Kotek. She was Speaker of the House while all of this was going down. So where is her voice now? Where is Multnomah County DA's? Where's their voice now? They have completely abandoned Tiffany and I. We were used to an office that for over 3 decades stood by our side every single step of the way. Legislation, work groups, parole hearings. They have been silent since October. And that's the other one that I am absolutely calling out because that is.
Jim, this is so outrageous, Danielle. You know, you've got an attacker who tries to silence you. That is what rape is doing. They are trying to silence you by intimidation. And now you've got a system that keeps these victims silent, Jim, through things like statutes of limitations and not categorizing them as victims and not letting them speak at parole hearings and ignoring the original sentence. And now it's the elected officials that are keeping the victims quiet because what they have to say is what? Inconvenient?
Yeah. Well, let's just talk about the statute of limitations. The purpose for a statute of limitations is that over time, witnesses' memories fade, documents may go away, whatever. Those statute of limitations are antiquated. Today, with science, you can prove in many cases, beyond any doubt, that the person committed the crime. 5 minutes later or 500 years later, you can prove it. You don't need a statute of limitations because science has given us the advances that it's not just going to be based on somebody's memory. And so we should destroy all the statute of limitations many times. And in child sex cases, there have been moratoriums on the statute of limitations. Sometimes in you know, they've wiped them out completely in some case, in some states, in some cases. And they've also civilly had moratoriums for a year or two where you could still sue after the statute of limitations had already passed. It's just an antiquated notion that just really shouldn't apply ever, because as long as someone can commit, when we understand that serial crimes can be committed over and over and over again by the same offender, it's not like somebody, you know, ran a red light accidentally once. No. This is somebody who
it's not a mistake.
Grew up
right,
living this, thinking about this, breathing this, fantasizing about committing these crimes. And clearly this asshole has never stopped doing that.
Right, right. No, I mean,
especially when he's keeping lists of victims. He has. That is another criminal violation.
Yeah,
it is. Wasn't prosecuted him in. For.
And so I think, Danielle, what I'm struck by about this case, in addition to all the injustice that there is your courage and the courage of Tiffany to step forward and to become a face of sexual abuse survivors and sexual assault survivors. And so that you can try to make change. I mean, that is what I found so incredibly admirable about you and Tiffany. And so what I want our listeners to know is the kind of work that you're doing now. What are y'all doing now? And can they help? And tell us how.
Oh, definitely. If you're in the state of Oregon or even out, you can actually call the governor's office and give your opinion. And then state legislators are the key here. So in regards to the statute of limitations, we have eliminated it with DNA evidence. What remains is cases like mine that were not solved by DNA. We set at 6 years until 2015 when I went back to get 20. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee is the one that stops it from going anymore. I do have a bill to extend it. And I'm sorry, given the Me Too movement and understanding what we do about sex crimes, having a statute of limitations is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
Yeah.
This shouldn't have, I understand what they're saying about DNA, but why are you qualifying the exception to the statute of limitations?
Right.
Just delete the statute of limitations.
Exactly.
It should be obsolete. There shouldn't be one.
Right. And we're facing the same obstacles here in Oklahoma, trying to eliminate the statute of limitations. So I moved out of the state of Oregon once we knew when Gilmore was getting out. And I continued my advocacy and activism here in Oklahoma. And I work at the national level with the Joyful Heart Foundation. So it definitely has led to a life that I never saw myself leading. But sometimes you're given a story, you know, that you have no other option but to either just let it happen or you have to speak up. And I've chosen to speak up. So I do advocacy, you know, where it's needed. I'm not ashamed to say I took a job at Target doing drive-ups to pay for my advocacy. So I go back and forth from here to Oregon and other places. I spend my own time, money, resources, do public speaking. I do it on my own dime. And I thought,
well, people who are listening should definitely reach out to see about getting you as a public speaker. But also you said you do some advocacy with the Joyful Heart Foundation.
Yes.
That's Erin Runyon's foundation on behalf of her daughter, Samantha Runyon, isn't it?
No, that is Mariska Hargitay's foundation.
Oh, Mariska Hargitay's foundation.
Yes, from Law and Order SVU. Yes. So that's her organization. Yeah. So I work closely with them on policy and advocacy, and they've been a huge help in Oregon and Oklahoma and other areas for me. So
thank you so much for doing that.
Well, I know where can people sort of donate? Do you have an idea where money could help?
I do not have an organization myself, and that's part of the beauty of what I do is I'm not owned by anyone. So I can hold public officials accountable. I've held governors accountable. I've done press releases against attorney generals to get them to act and take responsibility against legislators. So it puts me in a bracket that I can do all of that. And there's no one that they can go to and say, you need to tell her to be quiet because this is getting
embarrassing. When are you running for office, Danielle, there in Oklahoma?
I have been asked that before, but then I wonder would I lose my effectiveness?
So well, you might. There's all sorts of rules, but I have to
to tell people, at least here in Georgia, you know, our legislature runs from January to May. So they're part-time legislators and as opposed to the Congress in Washington, D.C. But here, it's generally speaking, defense attorneys. It's almost always defense attorneys criminal defense attorneys who are in the state legislature. Prosecutors, sitting prosecutors, assistant district attorneys are not allowed to have outside employment. They cannot run for office and they cannot help make the laws in the state legislature. So it's most of the time criminal defense attorneys who can do whatever they want and whatever kind of work they want. And so they have zero incentive to see that their clients are spending longer times in prison. So there's like a conflict of interest in the state legislatures on these issues.
You know, Francie, what really, really drives me and what I thrive in doing is actually being able to change laws that affected me, that I didn't get justice. But every time I change a law and somebody else gets it, then it's my justice too. But I thrive off of that. I thrive off of helping other survivors. And I think ultimately what I would love is to have more of a national platform to be able to help survivors in other states to push back when you're told no. And we've been told no more times than I care to admit. But every time we were told no, we said, no, we're going to fight this. And we've won. So I would like to be able to help other survivors to be able to push back against a system that should be protecting them, but isn't. And to be able to change their laws too, because your state laws are going to be what affects you the most, not the federal.
No question.
But what happens at your state level is going to dictate whether you get justice or not.
Well, and as I said earlier, you're active on social media. Everyone should follow you on Twitter so that as you're posting information about where you're going, where you're speaking, what laws that you're trying to get changed, what officials people need to call, they can get that information. What's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is just at DanielleTudor62. So that's my Twitter. And that's my public Facebook page is Danielle Tudor, public figure. I post everything there. I post much more to my Facebook public page than I do to Twitter. So they can find what I'm doing on Facebook and Twitter. They can get me that way as well, but much more.
And it's T-U-D-O-R, correct?
Yes, like the house. The style of house.
Can I ask you something though? Do you have an email or other contact information for the parole board? Because I would love for as many of our listeners as possible from everywhere, not just this country, everywhere, if they could email the parole board and express their opinions about what they did in this particular case. Because this is outrageous. Outrageous.
Yeah. Or the governor's office, which appoints the parole board.
We're already
going to
do
members.
The governor. But I would rather the parole board suffer the consequences of what they actually did. It was them. It was they who usurped that authority away from the prosecutor and the judge who gave you the designation as of a victim. And they took it away from you. And that's just outrageous. And I think they should hear about it.
Oh, definitely. But like Francie said, they're appointed. So they are appointed at the pleasure of the governor. So obviously she's going to appoint someone or individuals that go along with their view of criminal justice. And I can tell you where Oregon is headed. Oregon is headed just by the bills that I see in this legislative session that are very pro-criminal. Oregon is headed, and you'll see it, I'm sure, within the next few years, where they're going to have a law that cases like ours, where the perpetrator cannot be charged for our crimes, they will be inadmissible in court. So you will never get the full view of what an offender really is capable.
They're going to gut similar transaction evidence. Similar transaction evidence is some of the most powerful evidence that exists, especially in cases of violent criminals. And especially in sex offense cases, it is incredibly powerful.
It's incredibly
and that is why they want to gut it.
Relevant.
They do not want the criminals that they apparently sympathize with to have to face those victims and face accountability by the courts. It's disgusting.
Yes.
It is so wrong. And I know Jim hates this word, but I can't help it. I'm a Southern girl.
It's just evil. It's just evil for these people to take this path that is clearly anti-victim and pro-criminal. And I condemn it in the strongest possible terms.
Well, that's why they are not willing at this point to stretch their guidelines. That's why they're sticking to, we only want to use the static 99. Because they don't want to hold an offender accountable for a previous
disgusting.
Crime.
Yeah. I don't understand it. What's happening again, Jim? This is another case that is a horrific commentary on the state of American justice today. I'll say it again. Someone should do a documentary on it.
Really? Yeah. Okay. We'll think about that. No, we don't have to think about it. I want to do it. But is the state of the entertainment industry going to allow a real no holds barred look at what the justice system is doing today?
I wish, but I fear we all know the answer.
Well, we've gotten convictions with Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, and then you have Jeffrey Epstein. So, you know, maybe we can get there. My perfect world would be living in Oklahoma half the year and then being in Oregon half the year and be a crime victim advocate in Oregon to make them have to make more changes, hold them accountable.
That would be
well,
great.
I feel like, Danielle, you can do anything you put your mind to. That's my vote.
It just takes money. That's all.
Yeah, that's always the case.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Well, thank you so much again, Danielle. And we're right there with you and support you and everything you're doing, and just hold you up as an example of a hero that, you know, we really look up to.
Thank you so much. I am so thrilled that I was given the information about your podcast. It was just, I wish we would have known about it even sooner, because, man, we feel like we've been out there just treading water, working against a system that's just like a tidal wave coming towards us. But you know what? I'm not going to give up. I'm not. I'm in it. Good. For the fight.
Great. Well, thank you
good
so
for
much.
You.
For that.
You're not alone.
Yes.
Well, again, thank you for being here, and you have our full support, and we just hope that you're successful in doing everything that you want to do. And we celebrate your life because you're an amazing person.
Wow. Thank you.
All right. Until next time, this is Best Case, Worst Case, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gergel. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness to Light can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.